G'day everyone, I am back from Sydney, which is fantastic. It's always very, very nice to be home. Sydney's not that far. For those of you that are not from this part of the world, it takes me about an hour and a half or something on a flight, a little bit less, to get from Gold Coast down to Sydney. So Scott and I were down there last week. Super easy airports too. It's like you just park the car, you walk in, no dramas. Very, very simple times. Be that as it may, it's nice being home. So, Sydney, we were doing NDC, so I did a couple of days of workshops. Of course, Scott and I came to you from NDC at the end of the event last week. It was just before we did our Cyberbroken talk. That went really, really well. My other talk there went really, really well. And incidentally, I publish every eval I get for every talk, the good bits, the bad bits, everything. So at troyhunt.com, I'm looking at the screen here, troyhunt.com/2018events, you'll find all those evals. Cyberbroken went great, 113 green, 6 yellow, 0 red. And if you've not been to an NDC event before, as everyone walks out, there's a stack of cards and you pick the color card you want, you chuck it in the box. So that was really good. My other talk, I'm pwned, you're pwned, we're all pwned, was 138 green, 0 yellow, 0 red. So I was really, really happy with that. It has been a little while since I've had a no yellow or red talk, so that is a good result. That talk is also now pretty much exhausted for NDC, so I need to come up with something all new for London in Jan. Now, the last thing we did at NDC as well, we did PubCon on Friday night. And if you've never been to a PubCon before, you can't go and watch the videos because there's no videos. It's not recorded. It is an event in a pub. We started doing it at NDC. We did the first one at NDC London, I think about, would be almost 3 years ago now. And Todd Gardner from TrackJS normally runs these. He had Lars Klint standing in for him this time because he was back in America. And it's basically 10 lightning talks, so like 5 minute talks where there's 20 slides per talk and they auto rotate after 15 seconds. And you need to, you as the presenter, need to sort of have your timing right because they're going to just, you know, progress. It's in a pub. It is a pub orientated talk insofar as it can be a bit crude, it can be a bit leery. I've never seen anyone being dicks about it, which is really, really good news. So, you know, certainly you need to, you know, be a nice human being when you do these things. But all of the sort of, you know, corporate political correctness and everything goes out the window, and they are very, very fun talks. So they were awesome. Scott made it into the finals this time. Scott did his first ever PubCon talk. He was a little bit worried about it in advance between you and me. He was absolutely stressing himself. Anyway, he made it through to the finals and took out second place. So good news to him. I did not. As I am constantly reminded, I have never been able to win, but my wife has. So she has that. Anyway, moving on to other things. All right, so a few little general things before I talk about the big thing I wrote this week. So I'm talking to you on a new iPhone XS, which is basically the same as an iPhone X. there's very little difference. And it's funny, actually, because people get a little bit uppity. They're like, Apple put out a new phone and it does just the same thing as the old phone, which was actually really good. But because there's not new things, reasons, I'm upset, whatever else. Look, I tend to keep rolling phones as the new ones come over, and sometimes there's just incremental updates. So for example, I went for the half terabyte size, so now I just sync all the photos, and I've always got my photos with me on the phone, which is actually very handy when I'm traveling and I want to show people things they don't have to sort of pull down. The camera is improved. Apple has lots of fancy terms for what it is that's improved. The biggest thing that I notice is being able to adjust that bokeh effect. So you can take a photo which does the sort of blurry background and the very, very clear foreground in portrait mode, and then there's just like a little slider and you can change the blur on the background dynamically, which is really, really kind of cool. Like, there's some serious processing power going into all this. They're the main things. See what you think about this camera. It looks like a little bit, I don't know if it's a little bit lighter or clearer to me, the front forward-facing one. Maybe I just want it to be to justify spending money on another freaking Apple phone. Regardless, that's pretty good. The Face ID is faster. I'm inclined to say it's a little bit more reliable in the sun. I was very critical of Face ID on the iPhone X because I'm always wearing either these, and this wasn't intentional. It's just like they're always around. For listeners of the podcast, I'm holding up two different pairs of polarized sunglasses, which generally suck with Face ID. Not just me, it's myself, it's my wife, it's my sister-in-law here as well. We just have sucky experiences with Face ID. Some people sort of go, oh, well, why did you get another Face ID phone? Because you don't have a choice anymore. Not if you want to be in the Apple ecosystem. Now, some people go, oh, well, you know, you should, I don't think anyone's saying you should get a Windows phone, but you know, like you should go and get an Android or something. There was actually a tweet that I sent around during this week that got a lot of traction, which was, I was quoting Bob Lord, who is the CISO of the DMC in the US. Previously CISO, I think it was CISO of Yahoo, wasn't he? Anyway, so Bob had made the call to put everyone on iPhones because he said, look, that the situation with Android is that there's just so many different devices and then there's carrier settings and dependencies and things, and the rate at which they're updated and kept current with things like software patches and security patches just doesn't compare to the Apple ecosystem. And a lot of people sort of picked that up and mostly agreed. A few people went, yeah, but if you get a Google Pixel, then it's... And that's like just one other thing in this massive ecosystem, and relatively new too compared to the obviously the iOS system ecosystem rather. So anyway, as a security minded individual, I do like having the iPhones. Plus, there's the vendor lock in. Plus, all the family's got them, and it's just, you know, they're you do get monopolistic tendencies when you're all built into this sort of one ecosystem. Look, be that as it may, I'm very happy with the phone. I didn't get the Max. I didn't get the big one. The main reason for that is that I had, I think the last plus size phone I had was a 7 Plus. And I had this sort of pang of buyer's regret after I got it when I felt the size. And it's like, I just can't quite do the one-handed thing like I'd like to. Pockets are a little bit harder. Even the mounts in the car made things a bit harder. The heavier weight makes them, you know, they've got a bit more momentum when you turn the corner and they fall off, all this sort of stuff. So I ended up getting the same size again. But the other thing is, and again, this wasn't even planned, but I've always got the iPad somewhere very, very handy. So it's kind of like, well, I've got a big screen when I want it. So anyway, I'm very happy about that. One of the reasons I did actually go for the Plus phones previously is because they had better cameras. And I take a lot of photos because I've got kids and I travel and things like this. But now the cameras are the same in all of them. So frankly, it was just screen real estate and there just wasn't a good reason to go extra large in the body of the phone just for extra screen real estate. All right, so moving on, a few other little things. I shared a tweet yesterday about Uber getting a $148 million fine. Now, remember they had the incident. So this was 2016 was the incident where they basically span it as a bug bounty. So someone compromised and got a whole bunch of data. They end up paying the guys who found this incident $100,000, passed it off as a bug bounty when allegedly it was not. It was just people had gone and stolen their data and then ransomed them or something like that. It really wasn't a good look for Uber at all. And in fact, this news came out just as I was heading to the US to do the congressional testimony. And I was like, see, I told you that stuff happens a long time ago and then we don't know about it until ages later. I'd actually already written the testimony before the Uber thing, and then the Uber thing happened just before I delivered it, and everyone was like, okay, well, I guess he was maybe right about this. Now, the $148 million fine, I shared it and I said, look, this to me feels kind of commensurate. So in 2016, Uber had $6.5 billion worth of revenue. So $148 million makes it about 2.3% of gross annual turnover in terms of the scope of the fine. Now, I shared that and said that this feels reasonable. $148 million is a big whack. 2.3% is a big whack too. And there are a few people that sort of argued it and went, no, this is not enough because it's only like, is our data only worth... Someone in our street just got a Lamborghini Aventador. And every time I hear it, I just lose my mind because it sounds so epic. If you're a Tesla fan and not into supercars, you're not going to understand, but it is beautiful. Anyway, where were we? Uber, speaking of cars. So Uber obviously got that fine. People were saying, look, it's only like a few dollars a person or something. You know, think about the impact of it and everything. And I think we've... Like, trust me, I'm the first person out here who wants to see companies penalized when they screw up as badly as what Uber did. It has to happen. There's got to be a big stick here when people cock up that badly. By the same token, it needs to be commensurate, and it needs to be, I guess it needs to be scoped based on a number of different things. So, you know, what measures did the organization take to avoid it? What did they do, you know, in order to deal with it? They didn't deal with it very well. Also, what was the impact on the individuals involved? Now, something like Ashley Madison, people killed themselves. That's a very big impact. It wasn't just that. It destroyed lives. It absolutely tore families apart. Put the ethical discussion aside. That is a totally different discussion. The impact was it had a really, really major impact on people's lives. Now, something like that deserves, on the impact side of the scale, to have the book thrown at you. Uber had no impact on the individuals that we know of. And the reason is because the folks who got the data, again, allegedly deleted it all. It was never shared or redistributed or sold or anything like that. They got, well, I guess they sold it to Uber insofar as they got the 100 grand, but it was Uber's data to begin with. Actually, even that doesn't feel good, does it? Because it wasn't their data, it was other people's data. But it was data that Uber already had. Point being is that the impact was very negligible. In fact, I think it'd be fair to say that the impact on people like myself, Uber customers, was absolutely nothing. So when you're losing your mind and going 2.3% or $3 a person or whatever isn't enough, this should be the penalty for the shortcomings in Uber's processes. This should not be a penalty around the impact on individuals. Now, I've seen organizations try this on before. I've seen rather individuals try this on before. So, for example, after the CloudPets data breach, there were individuals who were trying to take class actions. It wasn't CloudPets, it was the other toy. VTech. So VTech, the Hong Kong toy maker, millions of people in there. There was class actions attempted against VTech, which failed, which seems kind of fair because VTech got breached. One guy had the data. He sent it to Motherboard. Motherboard sent it to me. There are three of us in the world who had the data. There was no impact on people. And as much as I hate organizations not getting absolutely beaten when they do the wrong thing, I hate individuals trying to profiteer from this. And going out there trying to mount class actions is just like lawyering up when nothing has actually happened to you. And maybe I felt bad because one other bloke in England might have seen my data as well as the Aussie and the journalist, and then everyone deleted it. Like, this is not cool. So anyway, I think the Uber situation was fair and commensurate, and it will sting. And if you're not sort of sure if it will sting, just think about it. Like, imagine round numbers, you earn $100,000 a year and you get a $2,300 fine. Like, that stings. That would hurt. All right, moving on now. Cloudflare, some really, really cool stuff has been happening with Cloudflare. So Cloudflare is doing their 8th birthday celebrations. They have had announcement upon announcement upon announcement about various things that they have released. And there's two that really, really stood out to me, and I want to share both of them here. One I shared a couple of days ago, and another I just saw a few hours ago. So the first one was egress data costs. So Cloudflare is creating what they've called the Bandwidth Alliance, which essentially means that if you use Cloudflare and your visitors go to your website, then they're going to go to Cloudflare. Cloudflare is then going to go to your hosting provider. So say Azure, in my case with Have I Been Pwned. I would normally pay a lot of money for data to come from Azure to Cloudflare. That's egress bandwidth costs. Cloudflare has set up this Bandwidth Alliance to drive those costs down. And they didn't share the exact numbers, but the announcement they made basically said there's going to be massive discounts on the data cost because they can get it at a massively discounted rate between Azure and Cloudflare infrastructure. Bandwidth, in many situations, is a massive part of the bill. It is expensive out of Azure. It is expensive compared to a lot of other providers. If I can drive down the bandwidth cost between every request that has to go from Cloudflare back to the origin, that's going to make a big difference. When I shared these tweets a couple of days ago, I shared one of the tweets which had been liked over 1,000 times, which was one of the calculations about how much I pay for pwned passwords. And more than 60% of the cost was bandwidth. Now, I don't know how much of that 60% is going to come off. I don't know if it's going to be half or three quarters or all of it. I suspect it's going to be somewhere in between those ranges. But if it was half, And by doing nothing, suddenly I shaved 30% plus of my total costs off Pwn Passwords. Like that's awesome. I would be stoked about that. When you start running the numbers on Azure about using sort of terabytes worth of egress data per month. So imagine you're an organization, you're going, look, we're thinking about moving a bunch of stuff into there. We might be thinking about moving on-prem stuff into the cloud. And they look at the bandwidth egress costs and it's multiple terabytes worth of data. It can really quickly run into thousands of dollars per month, very, very easily. So this is massive because it's going to make it great for people that are already on there, like myself. It's also going to make it great for organizations considering the move. Now, very sort of, conspicuous by its absence is AWS. So AWS was not listed as part of that Bandwidth Alliance. So for the likes of Microsoft, when someone's sitting there going, well, I'm thinking about going to the cloud, what should I do? By the way, if I go to Microsoft, there's no egress bandwidth costs. And it wasn't just Microsoft, there's Google and a bunch of others in there as well. That makes a really, really compelling argument to shift your infrastructure to somewhere like Azure. So I'm really looking forward to actually seeing the end result of that, seeing the raw figures. But that is obviously going to be a massive thing. Now, that was one announcement. The other announcement this morning, which is also a massive thing, is that Cloudflare is becoming a domain registrar. So that's really cool because, first of all, they're already doing all the DNS stuff for your websites. You have to use their name servers in order to use Cloudflare. So you're well and truly in the domain stuff. They're already doing a bunch of other stuff around making things like DNSSEC a lot easier as well. And the domain registration piece is kind of like just this last little bit. So at the moment, for example, I have DN Simple as my domain registrar, who incidentally have been absolutely fantastic too. So I'll go and register the domain there, and then I have to update name servers there to point back to Cloudflare. And then I pay $14 a year per domain. Now, people have actually said to me in the past, I said, look, you know, that's actually a bit of money. That's a bit more than you'd pay with GoDaddy or something. First of all, I am willing to pay money not to have to use GoDaddy. That works fine for me. Second of all, the Cloudflare model is to sell domains at wholesale prices. And that wholesale price means $8.03 a year per domain. Now, that, again, is like a massive discount. So that's, you know, taking the DN Simple example, that's $6 a year off a domain, which might not seem like a lot, but I do have about, I think I've got 40 or 50 domains or something. So, I mean, let's say it's 50 for simplicity's sake. That's several hundred bucks a year if I roll them from DN Simple to Cloudflare. Now, again, I mentioned loving DN Simple, and I sort of hate to see things made hard on them, but I think it really will make things hard on domain registrars. Interestingly, in Cloudflare's announcement, that the first sort of paragraph was, no one ever says they love their domain registrar. Well, actually, I do. I do love DN Simple. But I'm not going to be able to argue about the change to Cloudflare with the cost impact and the way it would tie into other services, and also the fact I love Cloudflare as well. So look, if nothing else, it's good times for those of us buying domains and obviously running services, between driving the bandwidth cost down to run the thing less, to buying the acquisition of the domain costs or the domain costs themselves down, through to all the other bits, like the fact that Azure Functions, man, like every time I do the numbers on how much Azure Functions is costing me, it's just ridiculously small. Obviously, Pwn Passwords benefits a lot from huge, huge cacheability. But even have I been pwned, I've moved most of the APIs and have I been pwned into Functions, and my costs are going to come down absolutely dramatically as I start scaling back the web server. So, you know, instead of running an app service that runs all these APIs and they have to scale up and down everything, all that goes away. So very, very happy about all that. Alrighty, now moving on to other things. So Firefox Monitor was launched this week. So this is the integration that Mozilla has done with Have I Been Pwned? And I spoke about this several months ago. They announced it. They did a whole bunch of studies. That whole thing kicked off a couple of days ago to much fanfare and positive press, which is fantastic. So now you can go, you know what, I'm going to make sure I get all these links right, because as much as I have spent time like building APIs and things, I think it is monitor.fi. It doesn't help that my microphone is like right over my keyboard here. Monitor.firefox.com. And you go there and you enter an email address and you can search for it and then you can subscribe to notifications, and it's all backed by Have I Been Pwned, which is fantastic. And here's the reason it's fantastic, because a number of people have said to me, like, what's the point? The reason it's fantastic is Firefox has reach. Mozilla has reach. Look, Have I Been Pwned is going great. Don't get me wrong. There's about 250,000 people a day coming to the site. Certainly 250,000 unique visitors. Obviously, some of those are bots and things as well. So it's great. But that is nothing like the reach that Mozilla has with Firefox. So I've been very eagerly watching the Azure function that they hit when they do the K-anonymity range searches. If you don't know what I mean by K-anonymity, go and search my name, K-anonymity. It's awesome. So I've been watching the traffic. They're doing a heap of searches going through. There's a heap of people subscribing for notifications, also using the same anonymity model. And this is fantastic because more people are seeing their exposure. And they can go and do it on Firefox for free, just so they can go and do it and Have I Been Pwned for free. So look, it's nothing different. If you've already used Have I Been Pwned and you're sort of wondering, should I use Firefox Monitor as well? Well, you can if you want, but you're not going to get anything you don't get already. It's exactly the same thing. The difference is the reach, and I just can't understate how important that reach is. So fantastic news there. Very, very happy to see that having been launched and going very, very successfully. All right, now, the thing I wrote this week, let me get to the pointy end of today. I got a pie hole. And that does sound like a little bit of an odd name, so let me give you some background on this. Pi-hole is a software product that runs on a Raspberry Pi, and it acts as a DNS resolver. So what you do is you get your Raspberry Pi. I went and bought one that in Aussie dollars, I think, worked out about $100 and a little bit. Just a pre-made kit. This is all in the blog post, by the way. I'll link to the one I got. Looking at the image here, it's obviously got the Pi itself. It's got an enclosure case. It's got a couple of heat sinks. Comes with a 16 gig micro SD card, power supply. Job done. Bought this. Got shipped to me by a company down here in Australia called Little Bird. They were really awesome, actually. They sent me a nice personal email as well. They said they like what I do. it's just nice to know that people are actually paying enough attention to look at who the customers are. So that was cool. You get that. And then you go and you download the Pi-hole software. And then you have problems installing it because I had some various dramas. I linked to that. Minor dramas in the scheme of things, and the Pi-hole folks were absolutely epic in terms of support as well. You get it set up. When it all goes well, it's really only a few minute job. And then you go to whatever network hardware you're using. So for me, I went to my Ubiquiti security gateway, and I set DNS to use the Pi-hole. And then when I set the Pi-hole up, I set the Pi-hole to use Cloudflare's DNS, so it resolves to 1.1.1.1. So what it means now is any device on my network, when it does a DNS query, it's going to be hitting the Pi-hole. The Pi-hole is going to do the DNS resolution, and then it's either going to go to Cloudflare to pass that query for DNS on, or it's going to Pi-hole it, also known as black-holing it, hence Pi-hole, etc., Raspberry Pi, hole, black hole. You get the idea. Now, why do we want to do this? The reason we want to do this is because it means that the Pi-hole can use well-established lists of nasty domains that you really don't want to be going to. So, for example, domains that serve ads. Now, there's going to be a whole other discussion we're going to have in a moment about blocking ads and ad blockers and all this sort of thing, but let's just finish the mechanics first. So I've got some examples on here. Let's just go to the big sensational one. I show Daily Mail. It's funny, you know, because in my blog post, I sort of said, I feel that sort of the smuttier the publication, the more ads and crap there are on there. Someone actually got upset with me on Twitter. They're like, some political thing? Oh, you're too left-leaning. I don't know. Like, I just don't even care. Because here's the point, right? So I go into the Daily Mail, and there's a screen cap of this in my blog post. And there's a massive ad across the top. And then there's a vertical ad on the right and another vertical ad on the left. And then there's a video ad in the middle. And there's freaking ads everywhere. You turn the Pi-hole on. And then when it tries to resolve the domains that are requested. So imagine, just to sort of dumb it down to the last common denominator. Imagine you load a web page. Web page says, hey, go and get this script or this iframe or this image from this domain, which is an ad domain. Pi-hole, when it gets the DNS query, is just like, nah, I'm going to black hole that, basically say we don't know that name, and the browser goes, okay, well, I just can't load it. So then it loads, and all the crap has disappeared. So now it's just the news story. Now, in case you're thinking this is just like an ad blocker, it's not quite like that, and we're going to come back to why. Now, in the case of the Daily Mail, the original load, I actually left it sitting there. So I just like opened the Daily Mail, left it sitting there. After 17.4 minutes, because it was still making freaking requests after 17.4 minutes, this is with no pie-hole, it had downloaded 57.6 megabytes over 2,663 requests. This is what happens when you open the Daily Mail. That, call it smutty or left-leaning or whatever political allegiance it is, it's just bullshit. So that is bullshit. Now, I turned the pie hole on. In fact, I had two machines. I had one just directly resolving through Cloudflare's DNS and one through the pie hole. With pie hole, the 2,663 requests went down to 175. The 57.6 megabytes went down to 2.1 megabytes. And the whole thing finished in about 5 seconds as well. So this is like, this is just an absolutely massive, huge difference. Now, here's the other thing that's sort of cool. There's a dashboard. So you can go into the dashboard, you can see total queries. So I'm going to talk about the screen caps here, and then I'm going to talk about stuff you haven't heard before, which is what I'm seeing as of now. 17,500 total queries by 19 clients. There were 7,000, just over 7,000 queries blocked. So actually 40% of queries were being blocked. The domains on the block list numbered more than 130,000. So more than 130,000 domains where it's just like, no, you can't load this stuff. And then you get some nice graphs. And on the graphs, you can see which clients are making the most requests. You can see over time how many queries are being made, how many are being blocked. You can drill down on the client, see how many requests it's making, which specific domains it's requesting, which is really cool. Loads of stuff here around what is actually happening in your network. So I was really curious to see, for example, the things like the Wemo switch that I have for my coffee machine. I wonder where it's calling out to. You can see this now. It's very, very easy. I showed my wife's IP address for her laptop because that was making a heap of requests to mobile.pipe.aria.microsoft.com, which I've since learned is like telemetry stuff. So it blocks that too. One of the domains that it actually accepted was foxnews.com. And I kind of made a bit of a quip. I said, look, I'm going to have to go and talk to her about that. Figure out what she's doing on Fox News. Turns out she was actually trying to find us somewhere to stay when we're in Texas next month. And someone else actually put out, why do I read these tweets? Someone put out a tweet and said, oh, did you get her informed consent to track her? It's like, we sleep together. Like we have a level of trust which supersedes the, I might know which websites you're going to. I don't know. Some people just want to argue. So we won't entertain that any further. Anyway. A whole bunch of really cool stuff there. Now, why is this different to ad blockers? There's a few things here, and this is where some people got upset again. We've had the discussion about people on the internet getting upset, all right? When you run an ad blocker, you run it on one client. So we'll talk about the mechanics first, and then we'll talk about my more controversial views. So if you want to run an ad blocker, you need to run it on every single client. So you'd run, you know, whatever it may be on your PC and then whatever you want on your iPhone or whatever else you want on your other devices. Obviously, you simply can't run them on your smart TV or your Wemo coffee switch or whatever else it may be. But you have to go through device by device by device, install the thing. When you do this and DNS is resolved through whatever setting you have on your home router, and you can always override that and do DNS resolution on the client, doesn't normally happen. Although someone did mention that some smart TVs do that in order to stop black holing requests like this, which kind of is another level of shadiness, isn't it? Anyway, when you do it at the network level, everything you put on the network just inherits that security position, which is great. And it is a security position. There's a whole bunch of things you don't need that are potentially risky to get blocked. So this is one of the major things, being able to just do it once on the network and everything gets the benefit. You also get this unified central view of everything. What machines are making what requests? What are the top blocked domains? I noticed one thing really interesting here, which is when I when I fired up this interface just before I started recording here, is that right around, what time is this? Right around 8:30 last night, my time, there is a massive spike in the graph. So the graph's like steady, 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 woo, massive spike, and then steady again. And I've just noticed that what this massive spike is my new iPhone making 4,482 DNS queries in the space of 10 minutes. I don't know why. And the other thing is they're not blocked either. So when I look at the spikes, I can see that the total DNS queries for that period was about 4,600, and there are only about 67 that were blocked. There's a 1.4% block rate, which is interesting. So it'd be curious now for me to sort of drill down and go, okay, well, why did my iPhone go so nuts at that period? And this is like data that you're just not going to get from running an ad blocker. So there's that. Now, let's do the controversial bit. I dislike aspects of ad blockers, multiple aspects. One of the aspects is, and I think I might have even mentioned this last week, when you run an extension in your browser, it has a huge amount of control. And time and time again, we have seen extensions go rogue. Someone left a comment disagreeing with me on this in terms of, you know, look, you shouldn't worry about extensions because you run all sorts of code on your browser, or rather all sorts of code on your PC. And you do, but it's extensions which are just consistently going wrong. And I put a couple of links in there, like here's an article from June and there's half a dozen that have gone wrong there. Here's one from January and there's another four or five that went wrong there. And time and time again, they go wrong because someone writes an extension and gets a little bit of popularity. Someone else pops up and goes, hey, I'll give you 10 grand for your extension. And they're like some kid who's just made this extension that's, you know, now sort of going, well, 10 grand is like the world. Sure, I'll take that. And then bad dude turns that extension into something malicious and does anything from mining cryptocurrency to stealing passwords. So this happens at an alarming rate. And just besides all of this, don't run any extensions you don't need to. I suspect that there's also a propensity for people to run extensions in a much more willy-nilly fashion than going and downloading random software products from random sites. There's an expectation, I suspect, that because it's delivered via, say, Google, because you're updating Chrome or adding Chrome extensions, that it's trustworthy, which, of course, is not always the case. There's certainly not the same sort of overview that we get from an app store. We don't see the same sort of prevalence of things going rogue and being nasty in, say, iOS apps. So, evidently, there are lots and lots of occurrences of extensions going bad. And the point I'm making is that you do introduce a risk by running this untrusted code. And you do with any other code as well. But once you go out, grab third-party code, run it on your machine, there are risks, and we've seen them go wrong multiple, multiple times. If I have the option to do pretty much the same thing, but without taking on that risk, I think that's a good thing. Now, having said that, one of the things that ad blockers do, like let's be very, very clear about where they do well also, is that they can manipulate DOM elements. So they can actually remove, for example, the DOM element, which would normally have the ad in it. With the pie hole, you end up with gaps. It's like, look, there's the CSS of the parent website left room for a big ad. The ad hasn't loaded. There's now a big white space. And you can see that in the Daily Mail example I gave. Ad blockers can actually modify the contents of the web page so they can delete that out. Remember that they can actually modify the contents of the web page and see anything in there, so then we get to the potentially nefarious side again as well. Be that as it may, that's a technical upside. There's a more philosophical upside that I still struggle with, and it is the fact that ad blockers very often just don't give a shit. And I want to quantify what I mean by this, qualify what I mean by this. When I launched my revised blog, the one you see today, in early 2016, I got rid of all the ads and I put, maybe it wasn't when I first relaunched it. Anyway, shortly after, I got rid of all the ads, did the sponsorship thing. So now you'll see on my blog, there's a line of text. That's all it is. It is a line of text. If you want to sponsor my blog and have your message there, you get 140 characters of text. You don't get images. You don't get script tags. You don't get the blink or the marquee tag. You know, like you don't get anything like that. You just get text and a message. And I did that because I think that is the most responsible way of having any sort of representation by a third party on the site, call it sponsorship or ad or whatever you want. It's the most responsible way of doing it because there's no nasty stuff. There's no tracking. There's no chewing up your bandwidth or anything like that. And I really, really want to encourage people to do more of this. And I have seen more of this happen over time. However, there are ad blockers, and to be fair as well, it is often the list that they use which very deliberately remove that. And what I say, when I say very deliberately remove it, like literally when you're on TroyHunt.com and you see an element of this name, delete the element. And that really pisses me off. And the reason it pisses me off is not because there's any loss or anything to me. The sponsorship is a flat rate. It's one of the nice things about it. It's not like a pay-per-view or click or anything. I get paid exactly the same whether you block it or not. What bugs me about it is that it makes it harder to justify doing this as opposed to the other shitty ad things. You know, like what I'd really like, and I'm sure this doesn't impact my bottom line, but I do think it impacts the propensity for people to go down this path. I'd really like to see ad blockers and the list they use saying, look, that there are responsible ads. And responsible ads are things like a line of text, not tracking, not screwing up your bandwidth, not doing any of this. We're going to encourage them. And what seems to be the philosophy here is that some people are just like, nah, kill it all. Like, just burn them all. I don't want my eyes assaulted by any of this. I even had someone getting very uppity in one of these discussions saying, I'm sick of having my eyes assaulted when I go to this site and get this thing for free. It's not fair. It's like, dude, you're going to a site and getting stuff for free. Like, you know, how upset can you get? Maybe just don't go to the site if you don't like it. And I'm conscious, of course, then on the other hand, we're saying, well, yeah, run Pi-hole and block a lot of that stuff. But here's what it boils down to for me. I would really like to see sustainable models for people that create material. And I would really like to still get my material for free. And I really believe that the likes of sponsorship messages and just text or even just a simple image, non-offensive image, is the right way to go. And if we were to encourage publishers to do this more, I think this would be in everyone's best interest. So I don't have much patience for individuals that are just like, no, kill it all. I want everything for free. I don't want to see anything. And I might be unfairly influenced because I see, for example, one little line about DigiThert and locks and thermometers. It's like, come on. Anyway, that's my view on that. Oh, last thing on that. There, and I'm not even going to mention the name, but one of them, whoever is the guy, girl, whoever it is behind it, it was just constantly obnoxious about this position of, you know, we should be able to kill them all. And I just found really, I guess, a negative personality trait. And to sort of come full circle, I'm like, so this is this attitude and this person is the one that you're letting run anything they want in your browser. And when there's an update, you'll just take it. And if someone turned around and offered them 10 grand or 100 grand or whatever their threshold is, it's going to be their code and whatever it is running in your... Anyway, I just don't feel comfortable about that. So regardless, on the plus side, do look at the Pi-hole. The Pi-hole is really, really epic. All you need is a Raspberry Pi to run it on. You can get a super cheapy one. You can set it up in no time. I have had to whitelist one... Actually, let me quantify this. I've whitelisted one domain, which would normally on the blacklist, which is Google Analytics, simply because I need to use the analytics dashboard because I want to see where people are coming to my websites from. That is not the same as the Google Analytics tracking tag either, different domains. So you can still block the tracking tag, but use Google Analytics. And I've had one case of something not working. And this is after, what are we at, 2 or 3 days. And that one thing that wasn't working, I got an email from Telerik. I must be on a mailing list somewhere and I wanted to unsubscribe. When I went to unsubscribe, the host name couldn't resolve. I was on my iPhone, so it's just like, all right, drop to 4G, job done. You know, problem solved. Scott Helm, who sort of inspired me to do this because he wrote about it quite a bit, he's been running it for quite a while, and he said, look, he's basically got like two domains he's whitelisted, and other than that, like he just never has a problem. So I'll update you as time goes by, just in case things do change and I have some, you know, other problems or whatever. So that is that. Pi-hole is super awesome. Go and check that out. Very, very last thing. Speaking of sponsorships and responsible ads and things, DigiCert is sponsoring my blog this week. They're talking about locks and thermometers. IoT devices are everywhere in hospitality. Keep them secure with these 6 guidelines. So I've spoken a bit about DigiCert before. They're one of the CAs which really has been holding a much higher moral bar in terms of the way certificates and things are represented. I just remembered something we got to check too. I'll come back to that. So yeah, look, they've been doing a good thing there. They have been, I think, very responsible in the way they've been handling things like the Let's Encrypt situation and other sort of shenanigans that have been happening with commercial CAs. So they're doing a lot of focus on the IoT side of things and security as well. And they have written some pretty cool pieces too. The thing I just remembered, and I honestly don't know the answer to this, is the PayPal thing. Remember last week I mentioned that PayPal suddenly had taken away their EV cert. Yes, that had happened by the time I did my weekly update last week. I'm just trying to remember the chronology because I did my talk on Wednesday, and in my talk on Wednesday last week, we realized the EV cert was not showing. Now, and to be fair, it was still an EV cert, but because of screwy OIDs and Windows Trust Stores and things, you weren't seeing the EV name. I haven't checked this for a few days. I'm going to go to paypal.com now. It's just still not showing. So if you're on a Windows PC using Chrome and you go to paypal.com, we're still not seeing the PayPal name in the address bar. I don't know where to go with this. It's like, obviously, they're not losing gazillions of dollars or 40% greater shopping cart abandonment or whatever it is that the CAs are trying to sell it on. So is they curious? PayPal still does not show the EV indicator in the browser. And we're now 9 days on, and they just don't seem to be that worried about it. There you go, fun note to end on. So nice talking to everyone. I will be back here, still at home, next week, and there'll be a whole bunch of new things then. See you guys.